Today is Thursday, January 13th, 1994. This is Margaret Van Cleve. I will be interviewing Rudy Voigt, a longtime businessman in Fairbanks since 1949. This tape is made possible by a grant from Igloo No. 4 Foundation, Pioneers of Alaska. We are recording in Mr. Voigt's office at Motor Inn at 2550 Cushman Street in Fairbanks, Alaska. Now, people come to Alaska for a variety of reasons. It might be to attend the university, to find a job, serve in the military, or just to experience the living of Alaska, or life in the last frontier. Which of these categories do you think best describes your reason for moving to Alaska?
Well, I didn't even know where Alaska was or how I was going to get there. I didn't even think about getting there until I saw a movie that a man had made up here in Alaska. He showed dozens of caribou and some good fishing and some good hunting. And I've always been a hunter and a fisherman, even when I was a kid. So I thought, well, I can't afford to go up there and pay somebody to guide me, so I'll just go up to Alaska and become a citizen, and then I can hunt there. And I planned on staying a short time and making a stake and coming back, but I haven't got that stake made yet, and I've only been here 45 years.
Oh, well, describe your trip up the Alaska Highway. I guess that's the way you came.
Well, I came up with three other fellows, and we were all coming up to look for work because they paid big money here, and they were building Eielson Air Force Base. I decided to come up and learn, be an assistant or an apprentice carpenter, and that's why I come up. The other three people all come up for work also. We bought a 44 Chevrolet truck, and it had very few miles on it, but the tires were already a few years old, and we had 21 flat tires coming up the road. The road was rough and muddy and curvy. They've straightened it out a lot since. Every time that the truck stopped, somebody would get out of the cabin in the back. It was a van truck. Somebody would get out with a jack and a wheel wrench because they knew it was a flat tire. And we bought used tires on the way because we didn't have that many tires with us. We also bought a couple hundred dollars worth of groceries because we heard that eggs were a dollar a piece up here. So we bought a lot of groceries, had the thing full of groceries. And we came up the highway. It took us about 10 days. And other than flat tires, we didn't have any problems.
This would have been probably in May or June?
I believe it was in June, if I remember right.
So at least you had weather on your side at that point. Well, when you got to Fairbanks, what did you do about housing? I understand housing was quite tight in those days.
Yes, there was hardly any housing, but this truck van was a pretty nice hotel for us for all summer. We lived in the truck, and we had our groceries in there, and each of the other fellows got a job in town doing something, bartending and whatever. I don't even remember what they did. I tried to get a job as a carpenter, but there was a strike on, and there was nobody working. But I saw a little ad in the newspaper that said body and fender man wanted. So I went down there, and the fellow said, if you can put this thing together, it's one that a former body and fender man had tore apart to repair, replace some parts, and it was laying all over the floor, and it was pretty impossible to recognize where the pieces all went. Anyway, I said, I can put it together, which I did in a week, and I made more money that week than I ever made in a month before in my hometown.
Bet you never worked harder either.
Probably not.
In the meantime, was your family in Wisconsin waiting, or Minnesota, I guess?
My family was, at that time we had lived in Minnesota, and my family was in Minnesota, and I was here 3 months. Before I went back to get them. And when the time came that I had to get my family, I was working for this body shop. And I told the man that I'd have to take a month or 6 weeks off to go back, get my family and bring them up. He said, well, I can't let you have this shop stall sitting here for that long. You're going to have to pay me rent for that while it's sitting there. So I said, okay, I'll pay you rent for it. How much rent? He says, $150 a month. And I said, if I do that, I want to pay rent instead of work on percentage when I get back. He said, okay, I guess it'll have to be, because mainly because he didn't have, never saved his money, never had any money, and he needed this money. It was the only choice he had, is say he could, I could continue to pay rent. So when I got back, I was paying rent, and I was doing pretty good. And he decided he had to have a little more money. So he said, you're going to have to rent another stall in this building, because I can't just let you rent one stall and let the rest empty. I told him that I didn't need another stall and I couldn't use another stall. Well, he says, I'll find somebody else. I said, okay, I'll take another stall. That was, now it was $300 a month. It went on for another month, and the stall, the building, by the way, had six stalls in it, and he was using one himself.
So it'd be like a garage?
It was a long building with six doors.
Mm-hmm.
And each door a car would fit into, go into. And so I had to take another stall, he said, otherwise he'd find somebody else. And I was getting going along good, and I had a good business going, and I told him I didn't need the stall, but if that were the case, I'd take it. Then when it got to the fourth stall, I said no. And he says, well, I'll find somebody else to go in here. And I said, okay. And this fellow's name is Al Hoth. He's not alive anymore, but he was quite a spender, and he was driving cab for a living, and he didn't make enough money to suit himself, so anything he could get, he'd go after. Anyway, about the time that he was looking for somebody, the owner of the building came in, and he says, how are you getting along, Rudy? I'm getting along fine. He says, how much are you paying rent here? And I told him, I'm paying for three stalls at $150 a stall, and now I've got to take the fourth stall if I want to stay here. And this fellow said, Rudy, we don't need a middleman, do we? I said, no, I suppose not. Why? Well, he said, why don't you buy the place? And I said, I haven't got that kind of money. He said, could you come up with $1,000? I said, yeah, I can come up with $1,000. He says, well, I want $60,000 for the place. And if you pay me $3,000 a year, you can buy it. I said, okay, I'll do that. So he tore off a piece of newspaper and he made a contract on it, and he made another one for himself, and I signed it, and at 6% I borrowed $59,000, and in 20 years I had it paid off. But the thing about it that was a little different was the man came in that owned the building, that I was renting from, and he says, Rudy, I found somebody to take the place, you're going to have to move out. I says, Al, I'm sorry, you're going to have to move out. I bought the building.
Turn the tables on him.
And he walked up and down that building like a tiger in a cage for about an hour, and then he finally left, and I never saw him again.
So this would have been 1949, 1950, just within the first year that you came?
That would have been 1950.
Mm-hmm. What are some of the other things that you remember about, life in Fairbanks in the 50s?
Well, I remember that the town had 9,000 people, and it was a small town. It didn't have any other body shop, and anybody that wrecked a car had to come to us. And finally, eventually, another body shop opened up. The streets were not paved. And surprising how people now are worried about oil in the ground, but they oiled all the streets in Fairbanks at that time to keep the dust down. this country has so much of that glacier dust that if it isn't oiled or put kept down, it's dusty all over. When a car goes by, you can't see anything. So it was just a little one-horse town, and you knew everybody. And for instance, I had a friend that I met a month before that I borrowed several $1,000 from just to help me get started in business. He didn't know me before, but he trusted me, and with a handshake, I borrowed money. You can't do that anymore. We never locked our doors. Things like that I remember. And of course, everybody that was here those early days remembers 4th Avenue where the prostitutes were.
Oh, yes.
In the little houses all along there. You'd walk along and they'd be sitting out in front of the houses. That's all gone.
That's about good. Where Woolworths and Penny's is today?
Just the other side of Penny's. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the street the other side of Penny's.
Was there a fence around that area?
There wasn't.
Was it then?
It was wide open.
Wide open, just little cabins lined up one after another.
One after the other, just all little cabins. And, well, I don't know.
Where was your body shop located? I guess the core of town was where most of the businesses were located at that time.
The body shop was on 11th Avenue, about a half a block off of Cushman, 536 11th Avenue. And we were there for about 20 years. And then when the pipeline started, we got so busy that we had cars waiting a month ahead, and we needed a bigger place. That's when we built this one.
Yeah, where you are now.
Right.
Yeah, where did you live close to your shop?
I lived in the same block, yes, with the shop. I also bought the house that was on the same block.
On the same
block.
That
was part of the purchase. There were three houses on the block, and two of them, well, one of them we moved to Goldstream Valley, and my son lives in it now. And the other one I sold, so anyway, that was home and work at the same place.
You didn't have to do much commuting.
No, I could walk home for lunch in about 2 minutes.
A lot faster than it would be to warm up a car and drive anyplace.
That's right. No gasoline.
Did people put up their cars in the winter for the most part, or was there a fair amount of travel around driving? The townspeople, I know in the early days, a lot of people just put their cars up for the winter. But I guess by the 50s...
By the 50s, they were driving pretty much.
So they were. It was a year-round operation
Year-round thing. As soon as they developed heaters to start to keep those cars warm, they drove cars all
the time. You mean the circulating heaters?
Circulating heaters, yeah. Yeah.
So you came during territorial days, and I guess, well, in the early 50s, there was a lot of talk about statehood. What do you remember about the political climate of Fairbanks at that point?
Well, all the very conservative people didn't like the deal that was made for statehood. They didn't like statehood because they were afraid it was going to be too much government. I voted for statehood because I thought it would bring more people in, more customers in, so I'm sure I had to have been wrong, but we got statehood and we have to live with it.
And we certainly have a lot more people.
We've got a lot more people.
You mentioned that Alaska hunting and fishing certainly sounded appealing, and that was one of your reasons for moving up here. Did you get a chance to do some hunting and fishing?
I hunted every fall. I got involved a little bit with some other guides when I was hunting as a friend, not as a client. And finally I decided instead of taking vacations someplace, I might as well get paid for my vacation, so I became a guide. I had to pass quite a tough test, but nothing like they have to do today. And while I was guiding, I would take a month off every year off of my business and go guiding, and my son would run the business. So everything worked out good. We were hunting bear, and we were hunting moose and caribou, and I just had a vacation and a ball during that time.
Making money at the same time. Where did you do your hunting?
Most of my hunting was done around Arctic Village, up north of here, a couple hundred miles.
So you had your own plane?
I had my own plane. We did have a little fallout with that plane one time. We put some oil in it and forgot to put the cover on the oil. And on the way flying home, the windshield got all splattered with oil. It come out of the oil filler hole, and we couldn't see forward. So I thought I better land this thing and wipe that oil off before I get near Fairbanks, because I might have a collision with another airplane if I couldn't see forward. So I found the lake and looked out of the side window. I turned sideways, looked out of the window, and looked pretty good, like I could land. But when I got near the water, I was afraid I was too far in the lake and I couldn't see forward anymore. So I looked down, and the water was real glassy, and I thought I was getting too close to the end of the lake, so I thought it looked like I was 100 feet high, so I thought I better get down a little quicker. And as I lowered the nose of the airplane just a trifle, I hit the water. I was only about a foot up when I thought I was 100 feet up, and it tore a float half off, and it rolled over, and I was on it for 2 days and two nights. The water was too cold for me to swim, and I had some empty cans in the airplane. And if I could get in that airplane and get those cans, I could float to shore on them. So I tried and tried and tried, and every time I tried, it was so cold I couldn't stand it, couldn't do it. Finally, the last time I did, I got down and got the cans, and I got my rifle on a rope. And I tied the cans together with my shoestrings and laid across them and floated to shore.
What kind of cans were these?
5 gallon gas cans, empty gas cans that we were bringing back. And anyway, I floated to shore on those cans. And when I got to shore, a little airplane flew over, the first airplane I'd seen in all that time. And I waved a can around my head with my hands like this, and anyway, that little airplane wiggled its wings, he saw it, and the mosquitoes were so thick, I just couldn't keep them off of me. And in about an hour and a half or two, I'm not sure just how long it was, because I fell asleep. I crawled under a bunch of spruce boughs where the mosquitoes didn't bother me and fell asleep. And pretty soon I heard that chopper, and I don't know how long it was, but the 10th rescue come picked me up, took me back. Sold the airplane the next week for as is, where is, for a couple $1,000s.
Did that end your flying career, or did you buy another plane?
We bought another plane, yeah. Bought two more planes in the time that I was flying. But then when I got to be about 70 years old, I decided that it was old enough, better stop flying.
So you did the hunting for quite a while then?
Yeah. I was hunting and guiding for about 20 years overall. Not always with an airplane, but with an airplane when I had one.
Did you guide with, go in partnership with other people guiding, or were you mostly on your own?
No, I was guiding by myself.
Mm-hmm. But you knew it probably a lot of the other guides.
Yeah, we had to have certain areas that they assigned to us, and we could only hunt in certain areas. So
is that by lottery or by seniority?
I don't know how they did it. They assigned areas to guides. I know I had a cabin where I stayed when they started to assign areas, and my cabin, it was given to some other guide. That's when I quit guiding.
In the meantime, going through the 60s, you mentioned that you had your business on 11th Street. You must have been at that location when the flood hit, 1967 flood.
Right. We were on 11th Street, and the flood came up on the Northwood building downtown. It was about 8 feet up the wall where the flood was, the height of the flood. But in our location, we were on 11th Street, we were above the flood to the point where it came just to the curb but didn't come over the sidewalk curb. The streets were full of water, but the sidewalks were still
dry.
Clear. So we got by pretty fortunate on that. During the flood, the first, it was about 3 or 4 days, we were running a riverboat through town, picking up people from buildings that couldn't get off because of the deep water. We hauled medicine, we hauled water. Our boat was running 24 hours a day for 3 to 4 days.
Yes. And then I guess later you might have had to pull trucks and cars
repaired. After the flood, I would say 75% of the cars in the area had to be what they called pickled or cleaned. When we talked about pickled, we used the term because we drained the oil and filled it with diesel fuel so they wouldn't rust until we could get to them and and clean them out and do the engines and let all the water out and do the engines and oil them again.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of cars were destroyed in that flood.
Just because they couldn't be worked on right away?
Get to them right away. And even those we got to always smelled like they'd been flooded.
Mm-hmm.
The water got in the upholstery and never dried properly, and it smelled. And they didn't sell good because people could smell when they were
a lingering aroma. I remember that flood smell for quite a time afterwards.
I was on a trip with my riverboat, and I went across the river from Lower Second Avenue and down the river a ways, and I hit a concrete basement with my boat that was tumbling in the water, concrete basement from some building. And one of the concrete rods that they reinforced concrete with went through the bottom of my boat and cut about a 2-foot gash in the bottom of my boat. And that was right in the center of the river. And I drove, run the boat towards where the armory is now. And it was filling with water. And when I got to the armory, there was only 2 foot of water, and there the boat sank. That's where it stayed.
Bottom of the Chena.
Yeah, if it would have gone down in the river, I'd never made it. The river was really boiling and flowing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, still pretty high at that point.
Yeah. Yeah, that was quite an experience.
Yeah, one that we hope we never have to see repeated in this town.
I don't think so.
Well, what was the 100-year flood, so I think we're off the hook.
Yeah.
So we no longer, or no sooner recovered from the flood, and then, of course, oil was discovered in the North Slope, and eventually Fairbanks realized a lot of business because of the pipeline. What impact did pipeline have on your business?
When the pipeline road was being built, there were hundreds of big trucks hauling pipe up the road, big loads, and we had to have some bigger tow trucks than the normal car towing tow trucks, so we went out and bought a couple of 140-ton, 125-ton tow truck. And the road was poor and muddy and slippery, and sometimes when we got a call to go out and pull a truck out of the ditch, we had to pass as many as 100 rigs that were stopped behind him waiting to get him off the road so they could get through. And those trucks were busy 24 hours a day. We had 3 shifts on the trucks, 2 people on each truck. And we made quite a reputation because we had a lot of experience then. We were going all the time. But it was the thing that helped us financially enough that we could build this new building, which we're still paying for, of course, but that's beside the point. Yeah, the pipeline raised wages, people's wages, the city employees' wages, the people working for us all had to have pipeline wages. And when the pipeline was done when the work was all over, it was hard to tell these fellows that we're going to have to cut your wages a little bit.
Yeah, you get used to a certain standard, it's hard to go back.
Well, the reason it's so hard to go back is because they buy according to that standard, and they
right.
make payments according. They buy houses with certain payments, and if they lose their some of their wages, they can't make the payments. It's a little tough. I can mm-hmm. I can understand that.
Yeah, I remember how there was a big jump in the price of housing, people's wages. It was all relative, but it was certainly...
Well, we still hear about it with the fire department and the police department.
So most of your business in terms of the pipeline was towing people off the road.
Yeah, that was how we come. The only way we were involved was mm-hmm. through the
So train. It was no hauling or anything like or repair. What about repairing rigs?
No, we didn't do any. We done alignments and wheel balancing, and that's about it in that time. And of course, we had more work than we could handle because there were more people in town, more cars mm-hmm. and trucks. So
you had your normal business before that, and so it really doubled your workload?
It got too much for us to handle it in the little building. We had to move.
Mm-hmm.
So.
And at that time, I remember reading about you, and I guess it was in the 70s, you were involved in the Populist Party. Why did it become a political force at that particular time? What was happening that this suddenly became, or at least I was aware of it then?
In the world at that time, in the United States at that time, they were gearing up already that long ago for this new world order that is being formed right now. And there were a lot of people that were against this new world order because it's going to take the sovereignty away from America, and the Populist Party was against the movement towards the new world order. They wanted to keep America America and keep it free. And I was involved in it because I believe strongly in America. I've always flown an American flag in front of my business. And I wasn't quiet about it. I let people know that I liked America. And I guess I got quite a reputation for that right at the present time.
So was there an organization in Fairbanks at that time, or was it more?
No, there wasn't. The Populist Party organization was very small here in Alaska. It was heavy in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And I took a trip down and attended one of the bigger meetings. And there were several thousand people at this meeting that I attended. But for some reason, it's hard to buck the establishment, no matter how you cut it.
What relationship did it have with Alaska Independence Party and the Libertarian Party? Was there a similarity in among those three?
Well, the Libertarian Party has a platform that you could make legalize drugs and that sort of thing, which it had some good points. Take the profit out of it and people would stop using it, but I never believed in that. I never believed to take drugs. And one of my friends was the head of the Libertarian Party. He went to a big meeting in Seattle, and he said that while he was speaking at the meeting, he got so drunk from the marijuana smoke in the building, it was so thick you couldn't see, and he quit the Libertarian Party on account of it. Well, that's about the same reason I wouldn't have been in it, because I didn't believe people should take drugs, whether they paid for them or not. So, and the Populist Party was all for free country and less interference, less government, and more individual responsibility.
Mm-hmm. Sort of the Alaskan. It sounds a little bit like the Alaska Independence Party.
The Alaska Independence Party was different also. We were in the Populist Party, we were for saving America. the Independence Party was for saving Alaska.
That's right, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So it's quite a bit of difference. And with the establishment trying to pull the world together into a one-world government, they certainly weren't going to let Alaska secede from the Union, because they wanted them together at one-world government so they controlled it all.
Mm-hmm.
So it was considerably different than the Populist Party.
Mm-hmm. Who were some of the other people involved on the national level in the Populist Party? Do you recall some of the leaders?
On the national level, I don't remember names. Mm-hmm. It's getting too long ago. Locally, here we had we had people like D. Roberts, J. Pett, Wayne Pepler, Warren Prax, Lynn Funk, Dick Randolph, John Ritter, Glenda Spain.
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. And so, then I guess there were some groups in Anchorage, too, and some of the others.
Yeah, Anchorage had a group, too. I never got over there, so I didn't. You asked me about some of the people I knew from the early days in Fairbanks. I was on the grand jury when Ted Stevens was, district attorney here. And I got to know him personally because we were on the grand jury for 9 months. And some of the other people that I knew at that time is Les Nerland, all the Nerland family, I knew those. And Warren Prax, of course, was an earlier resident here. And the fellow that owned the only cab company in town, he and a couple other fellows owned it, Brown, the father of Brown and Sons, now the parts store.
Napa. Mm-hmm.
They called him Brownie. And Compo, Mr. Compo, Bob Compo is dead now, but his young son is, his son is running the store now. And Gene Emmel, the father of the two boys running the Chrysler Garage. George Nervous. There's another fellow in town that used to be a banker out of his back pocket, Mr. Barrick. He was a well-known individual in Fairbanks, and many people borrowed money from him. And it was pretty much like when I borrowed money from him, there was no paperwork, it was just a handshake. It was a nice country at that time. Lonnie Hall owned the Ford Garage, and before that time, Cecil Wells ran the General Motors Garage, Cadillac Garage, and Ernie Ginther, of course, was the original man in the Chevrolet Garage. Robbie Ginther is running it.
Interesting. There are quite a few businesses, including your own, that have second and even third generations running it.
I'm just hanging around a little longer than most of them.
Well, it's 82, you're still working, and I read in an article that was published in the Tow Times, that there are actually three generations of your family, your son and grandson, as well as yourself, doing the towing business.
We're all working in the building here as mechanics. I work more or less as an owner and run the business, and my son and his son working out in the shop.
So you were called the oldest heavy hooker left in Alaska, according to that article.
I believe I am. I talked to my doctor one day, and I said, there aren't many people as old as I am driving wrecker anymore. And he says, no, that's because they're all dead. So I guess I'm pretty fortunate to be around yet.
And your business is easy to spot from the road. I didn't even have to look for the address, the large American flag. You mentioned it was 20 feet?
20 by 30 feet. And it was the biggest flag in Alaska for a long time, but I understand there's one as big in Anchorage now. But that flag up there is not the flag we had 17 years ago. It's the 17th flag that we've had up there. The wind whips them out every year, and we put a new flag up, and they look pretty for a long time until they get ragged, and then we got to buy another one.
So you usually replace it in the summertime?
Yeah, we put the new flag up about the 1st of July, so that it's up the 4th of July.
I was going to say, 4th of July.
When the tourists come, they see the new flag.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, I'm pretty much an American, and I'll spend a little bit of money to prove it. I like this country.
Do you ever have anyone wanting to borrow the flag for ceremonial purposes?
Yes, surprisingly enough, the Eielson Air Force Base borrowed our flag twice, and this last year, Mrs. Connie Seekins borrowed it for a graduation.
Oh, one of the high school graduations.
Right. Yeah, the flag is, there's a lot of people say, where's Motor Inn? And the answer is where that big flag is. Everybody in town knows where it is because it's so big.
Is this an unusual size, or is it used for a particular purpose?
It is a garrison flag in the military. And most flags are 10 by 14 or something like a smaller flag, because it takes quite a flagpole to hold a big flag like that in a heavy wind.
Mm-hmm. How big is that pole in terms of diameter?
In diameter, it is about on the bottom. It's about 14 inches through.
Mm-hmm. So, pretty heavy pole.
Yeah, and it's 85 feet up in the air.
So you want that to stay upright.
I hope so.
Wouldn't want to get knocked over the head in a windstorm with that.
Yeah.
Now, looking back on your long career of being in the towing business, what were some of your toughest jobs that you recall?
Well, one job in particular was in about 1963 or 4. I was called to North Pole, which seems to be always colder than any place around close to Fairbanks. And when I got out there, the automobile, I think it was a Buick, was stopped in the middle of the road. It was just too cold. It wouldn't run anymore. He was on his way home and stopped in the middle of the road. And the temperature was 77 below on my outside thermometer on my wrecker. I hooked on to the back end of the car and started pulling it in, was going to bring it in the shop and warm it up. And I drove about a half a mile, and the back tires, something didn't feel right, so I stopped and looked, and the back tires had just disintegrated. There was lots of wire that is inside of the tires, but the rubber was all in little pieces of chips, like it exploded from the cold. In that cold weather, tires aren't tires anymore. They're like glass. So I turned the car around, and I pulled it the other way and pulled it another quarter of a mile, maybe a half, and the front tires went, same as the back ones did. So I had a pair of little, they call it a dolly, that you put a car onto on the back of my wrecker, and I loaded the car on those tires, on those little dolly tires, and brought it in. Now, those tires held up because they came out of a warm shop. And when I got in, I thought, oh boy, I'm going to have to buy this man a set of tires, because he's going to be mad. He's not going to like this. And when I got to him, when I talked to him, he said, don't worry. He says, they warranted. He had bought them from Sears Roebuck, and they bought him a brand new set of tires. So nobody got hurt except in Sears Roebuck. But can you imagine somebody warranting a set of tires for 70 below?
Well, I wonder if they still do. Of course, we haven't had 70 below, fortunately, in recent years.
Then we had another job that was a little different. A man was a man was clearing dirt with a D6 Caterpillar tractor. And he was driving along over the snow and got to a place where his tractor just went down, fell into a hole 20 feet deep, filled with water. He rode it about halfway down when he got out of the cab and swam up to the top. And of course, when they called us to recover that cat with the wrecker, it was a little difficult because we didn't know how close we could get to that hole without dumping a wrecker down that hole. So we had to stay back about 10 feet, and we had a 25 and a 40-ton wrecker. A diver had gone down and hooked the cable onto the cat that we could get a hold of. And we pulled that cat up with the two wreckers. It took us about 2.5 hours just to lift that up 20 feet.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, we pulled it out and pulled it to the side. And the fellow drained it, put it under a little tent, and heated it up and started and drove it away. Right. But that was one of the most unusual and difficult wrecker jobs we had. As far as trucks go, we've had them all. We've had 100-ton loads in the ditch, and we've had heavy loads tipped over that we had to right and reload. For 15 years, we were toying with them heavy wreckers, and in 15 years, you see a lot of things.
You've met every situation possible.
Everything you can think of.
And I noticed when I was looking at the pictures out in front, there was one of an airplane that had gotten tipped over in a ditch.
Yeah, the man was towing his airplane, had the wings tied to the side. He was towing it home from wherever he had been. I guess it quit flying, and he was towing it home, and it came off the trailer hitch and rolled over. So we had to bring that back, right it, and put it back on its trailer hitch so it could tow it in. Oh, there's been all kinds of them.
And all kinds of weather, too.
We get some of the worst weather when you get up to Adigan Pass. I've been in Adigan Pass and looked up at the snow in the Caterpillar tractors, the snowplows have cleaned the road up, and you look straight up and see snow, the top of the snow maybe 20 feet above your truck, and you wonder if you're going to get through it or if it's going to fall on you. And when we're working with some 20, 30 mile an hour wind, you can't hardly see the load you're working with, and it's cold.
So you've had a few jobs up there on Anakin Pass.
We've had a lot of jobs, all the way up to the Prudhoe Bay fields.
Mm-hmm. It's been one long hunting trip, 45 years in Alaska. Do you ever think you'd stay this long?
No, I was going to, originally I was going to stay about 3 years, but I have been back again a lot of times, and every time I go over the road, it's a little better. I've driven the road about 40 times, and I've been in quite a few of the other states since I've been up here, but I'm always willing and ready to come back. I like it up here, and I would be, there's no other place that I would like to live. I like it here.
Oh, well, thank you very much for sharing your thoughts with me this afternoon.